everybody. Thanks for listening to Constructive Criticism today. I just wanted to say for the late episode, I got in a car crash last Thursday, and I've been dealing with a bunch of that stuff as top of being a dad and doing a bunch of the other stuff that I do. Michael was out of town at the SEG, didn't get back till late Monday, so lots of travel for us and stuff like that. So thanks to these guys for doing the episode without me. I really appreciate it. And thanks to all the listeners who have reached out to me about my safety, making sure I'm okay. I am okay. I got a new car. I'm totally fine. I'll be back next week with some, hopefully, announcements. I'm not sure where we're at with some of the Patreon stuff, things like that. But I really appreciate Matt and Michael for pulling together this together without me. And I'll see you guys next week. But enjoy this week's episode where we talk about the standard environment from week one.
Stand-in host Michael, and I am joined by my co-host Matt.
Hey, how's it going?
Yeah, we don't even need anyone to say what's up.
Yeah. There's no real thought to, you know, what the other person's gonna say when there's only one of me.
I mean, just depends on how many personalities you have. I don't judge. So this week we are doing week one standard mega rankings, looking at results from the online PTQ as well as the team SCG, and I believe the classics as well.
Yeah, that's my understanding of it.
Yeah, so just the two of us this week, but you know, I think we have some solid info, and I hope it'll be helpful in terms of preparing for constructed PPTQs coming up, things like that. I know we're getting close to the end of PPTQs, but for those of you trying to qualify for these couple of Pro Tours, we're not quite there yet, so gotta keep holding on here for a minute. This show is brought to you by Oasis Games. You can check them out at www.mtgoasis.com. A ton of singles, tons of product in general. If you're in Salt Lake, come check them out. If you want to order online, you can use the codes CCMTG on your first order, and that'll get you 15% off. You can also use the code Would That Be Good, and that'll get you 4% off. And that one you can use indefinitely. In addition to Oasis Games, we're also sponsored by Ink Gaming. You can check them out at www.inkgaming.com. You can use our code, which is CCMTG10. And that'll get you, I believe, 10% off your order. It kick us back a little bit as well. So check out Ink Gaming if you're looking for a playmat, something like that. With that being said, we also have a lot of other great shows on this network. Things like Even Odds Podcast, although we don't have Mason here this week to promote his own podcast. So I undoubtedly will do a worse job than he did.
He's a master promoter. It's really hard.
Yeah, it's a high standard, and I'm sure I can't meet it. But I will still plug his show. In addition, you should also check out Common Knowledge, a podcast about getting better at Magic with a Pauper focus. And that is hosted every week by Brandon Clark. Really nice guy. Really, really good show. I've listened to it a couple times.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, so definitely check out the other shows on the network. You can find all these at constructedcriticism.com. As far as patron shoutouts, I don't think we have any this week. Spencer, I believe, has announcements to make regarding giveaways, patron tiers, stuff like that, but he hasn't made that announcement yet, and in the show notes, he did not list what they actually were because he thought he would be able to make this episode. So I don't have this information for you, but if you post in the Constructed Critics group, if you DM Spencer on Twitter or Facebook, I'm sure he will have that information up shortly.
Yeah, I also imagine that we'll get some announcements, you know, on the next episode.
Yeah, but just we should have clarification here soon on exactly sort of the future of the patron part of the show. And with that being said, we don't have any patron questions this week, just to free up our time for talking about Standard. And we will have probably a larger episode with patron questions, listener questions, stuff like that, coming at you next week. So we also don't have a Deck Doctor this week, and the power rankings are really sort of our main topic this week. So these are accumulated from the SCG Open, the SCG Classic, and the online PTQ. And maybe we should... Do you want to start with number one or number five, Matt?
I honestly prefer starting with number five.
Okay. So coming in at number five with 13 points, we have Esper Control. And this was a deck played to some success in the PTQ. It looks like there were a couple of 7-2s or so. It top-8ed the Open in the hands of Jonathan Rossum, and it came close to top-8ing the Classic, although it did not top-8 there.
Yeah, I'm actually fairly impressed at how similar the list from the PTQ is from Rossum's list, to be honest with you. It looks like they both had a lot of similar ideas with things like main deck, Moment of Cravings in some numbers, and, you know, Vona's in the sideboard.
My guess is they, you know, were working off the same list. I know that Shaheen Sarani had posted a fair amount about Esper earlier in the week, and I imagine that this list is similar to what he was suggesting.
Okay, sure. I got to see a little bit of this deck in action at the SCG, and it definitely looked pretty great against the mono red deck. It all comes down to how playable your mana is. You know, like, you have to definitely hit the tap lands at the right times and just be able to generally cast your spells and have the right number of lands. But it seems pretty strong when things are coming together for you.
Yeah, so with that being said, I would say the main difference between the list played by Pascal 3000 in the PTQ and the list that Jonathan Rossum played in the team open, Rossum opted for one more Field of Ruin in the main deck, bringing him to a total of 2, and opted not to play Evolving Wilds, whereas Pascal 3000 opted for only one Field of Ruin and 3 main deck Evolving Wilds.
Right, yeah, that's a pretty interesting decision. Clearly he felt like he could play, you know, a few more tap lands in exchange for having slightly better mana. So which archetypes do you think that having the Field of Ruins is better than Evolving Wilds? Because there's some trade-off against, like, the red aggressive decks either way, right?
Yeah, I'm a little bit inclined not to play very many Field of Ruins these days. I think that it hurts you in the blue control mirror, but I think it's only going to actually hurt you very much in the straight Esper mirror, because I think against blue-white you're going to find yourself relatively favored in the boarded games anyways. Just with
sure.
Duress, and, I mean, if you wanted them, potentially Knight of Malice or something like that.
Or, like, Bloodfast or
yeah,
you know,
exactly. I think there are better cards you can lean on than Field of Ruin against Blue-White. And I think in basically every other matchup, Evolving Wilds is going... I think I prefer Evolving Wilds to not playing Evolving Wilds. So I think it's a little misleading to say that Evolving Wilds actually is going to make you play more tap lands, because although you're going to have more tap lands on one, it will improve your check lands the rest of the game.
Sure, that's a very good point. You play a tap land, hopefully on turn one, to avoid having to play tap lands throughout the whole game.
Right, and if you think of it as, like, being able to play sort of extra checks, like, or extra hits for your checks, to have mana untapped on critical turns, I think that you're going to be more often able to slide a single tap land into your mana curve, and then have multiple check lands come into play untapped. If you have a hand heavy on check lands, you can get like a planes, because that'll check all of them. I think it gives you a little more play in terms of being able to stagger, like, because
yeah, mostly you get to decide when the tap lands are happening to you.
Exactly. Yep. So that's my inclination right now, but I could be wrong. Field Ruin is obviously a powerful effect.
And I'm sure it comes and goes with metagame positioning as well, right? Like you said, if you're playing the control mirrors, you're way less likely to be affected by your check lands coming to play tap, first of all, because eventually you'll find a basic land and then be able to you know, untap all your checks. The other thing is that, like, with Field of Ruin, if your opponent just has non-basics, it kind of functions the same way.
Yes. Yes. My concern is specifically against, like, mono-red and mono-green style decks, where you may have a little bit more trouble getting Field of Ruin online.
Right.
Those are the matchups for fixing your mana. It seems maybe most important, and I think playing a tap land might be preferable to playing a colorless land in those matchups.
Right, yeah, I can agree with that.
So, I don't know which is correct, and obviously, you know, I if you've had good experiences with one, I wouldn't necessarily just, you know, throw those away just because I think you should play Evolving Wilds, but my inclination were I to start testing this deck seriously tomorrow would be to start with a list with two or three Evolving Wilds.
Right. And I think more to the point, it's just it's noteworthy to, you know, at least try both.
Yeah, well, or think about times where one might be better than the other, right? Right. I mean, just something to be aware of.
But so how do you feel about this deck's overall positioning right now?
Well, I think my guess is that you are okay against mono red and probably pretty good against, like, the tokens and, like, Boros Angel, like, anything that's not quite as lean. I think the card Risk Factor specifically could be a problem, but I think the matchups where you get to line up, like, Cast Downs and Essence Scatters against your opponent's 1-for-1 threats seem likely favorable, and Teferi is still just as powerful as always.
Right, yeah, I mean, obviously they're pretty hedged for the mono-red matchup, like I said. I mean, multiple main deck, Moment of Cravings. And you have to realize that those are actually worth, like, more than one card if you actually kill something against the mono-red deck.
Definitely. I think that managing your life total is pretty critical. And I think that overall, these decks can be a little bit clunky. I think Syncopate especially is the kind of card that doesn't always age as well as you want it to, and a good opponent can make it harder than you would think with a card like Risk Factor to counter it. Or, like, I think if your opponent is playing well, you were talking about this earlier, but, like, I think it's pretty easy for them to make Chemist's Insight or Vraska's Contempt or even Teferi a little bit awkward.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you bring up all these cards, because on coverage they actually had a very specific scenario where it was actually really awkward for Rossum to have... He had Chemist's Insight in the graveyard and a Syncopate in hand, and his opponent was basically just representing Risk Factor, so he was never able to actually cash in this insight.
Right. The flip side is that when you're playing 27 lands, you may be better able to triple stone ring yourself than your mono red opponent if they really want to just represent Risk Factor indefinitely.
Sure. I mean, it was a little bit more than three lands, though, because they'd reached the point of the game where, like, the mono red player had, like, 10 lands in play. So,
sure.
Like, it was going to have to be, like, Syncopate for 8 kind of thing.
Yeah, it's possible, but you also have to remember that, like, you know, if he draws a Sinister Sabotage at any point, it just ends the game of chicken, and he probably just wins the game.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think it was a favorable position for him. It's a little bit interesting to see how a card like Chemist's Insight plays out in that way.
Definitely, and I think you could get into a similar spot with Teferi, you know, Vraska's Contempt, Ritual of Soot, or even Chromium, right?
Sure, just expensive cards in general.
Yeah, so I think there's maybe... I'm less inclined to say that I'm sure the mono-red matchup is good, but I think it's probably okay, and definitely on the, you know, the winnable side of things.
Right.
I certainly don't think it's, like, abysmal. That being said, one of my issues with this deck in the main deck is that you really are going to struggle answering an Experimental Frenzy. You can Teferi it away some percentage of the time, but if you can't do that, it's probably going to beat you basically every single game one.
Right, yeah, I can believe that.
It's just, you can't close games fast enough for that to not just bury you.
Right.
And not having access to Commit to Memory anymore, I think you'll feel it in that matchup a lot. That being said, I don't know that that's, you know, in and of itself such a big issue that I would not recommend this deck. I do think this deck is powerful. I think this might be the best Teferi shell we have right now. And if the Golgari decks continue to do well, something like this, I think, is exactly where you want to be.
Yeah, and certainly against, like, the Boros Angels deck, I have to imagine that matchup is pretty great.
Yeah, I would imagine the Boros Angels matchup is likely fantastic as well. So I think there are a lot of pros to this deck. I just, you know, want to make sure that we're kind of seeing both sides of, you know,
yeah,
where matchups
can go well. Yeah,
we're going to take
a more realistic perspective.
Right, where matchups can go well, but also where they can go poorly. So following up Esper Control, we have Green-White Tokens coming in with 17 points and in fourth place. And it was, I believe, both of the decks in the finals of the Open. And did not really put up any finishes other than that. Looks like it did not do well in the PTQ. Did not top 8 the Classic, but was both first and second place of the Open.
Right, yeah. It saw a lot of the bigger names on the SCG circuit playing this deck this weekend. I'm actually having a hard time figuring out what to make of this. Watching the deck on camera a few times, like, every card looked very good in doing what it was trying to do. I saw them create lots of advantage with this deck. The biggest problem that I saw is that there are an absurd amount of sweepers in the format right now, and they basically just folded to it every time. So, honestly, the majority of what I was watching, they were mostly losing with this deck.
Yeah, I think that we've sort of... My guess is this was very good against the level 1 red decks, and was also just kind of like, the cards are mostly pretty good, so I think it was likely a good choice. I'm a little skeptical of this going forward for a couple of reasons. The number of sweepers is one of them. I don't really want to play this deck against Ritual of Soot. I don't want to play this deck against a bunch of Deafening Clarions in main decks. I want to play this deck against red decks. The other thing that I don't like about this deck is that I was most impressed sideboard. Like, in the mirror, it felt to me like the Cleansing Novas and Immortal Suns were better sideboard technology than anything else. And given that those cards are basically completely unplayable in every other matchup, I'm a little scared of, like, the sideboard escalation that I would expect in this deck if it continues to be popular.
Right, yeah. Yeah, the Immortal Sun especially is a really interesting one to me. It's not the first place my mind would have gone. The Cleansing Novas kind of make sense, and I think that they actually do have applications in other matchups. Like, maybe if you played against Stompy or something like that, you might want them in case they ended up with, like, multiple Steel Leafs and a Galta or whatever.
Yeah, I'm not necessarily saying that they're zeros, but they're not cards I want a lot of.
Right.
But it's also hard for me to imagine winning a lot of games against opponents with more of them than you have in a mirror.
Yeah, definitely, I can believe that.
I also really don't like Settle the Wreckage out of this style of deck. My biggest issue being that when you don't really play any instance besides, like, March of the Multitudes, it's really easy for a good opponent to expose you as having it. And if they're able to actually, you know, attack selectively or, you know, quadruple stone ring you a couple of times, I just am really not a fan of that effect out of these mid-rangey decks.
Right. You know what card I was not impressed by this weekend? Was History of Vanalia. That card was very underwhelming every time that it was on camera.
We've kind of been in that mode for a while, right? It has its moments. Like, it's good on the play, but...
I would say even more so than usual. Like, in the past, when I played History of Vanalia decks, like, it was mostly the supporting cast that was kind of bad. Like, History of Vanalia was mostly pretty great, but right now, there were just... I mean, at least this weekend, there were just so many ways to pretty easily chump block it.
Yeah, my biggest issue with this deck... even beyond sort of the issues against sweepers and the History of Benalia style stuff, is that I really am not a fan of how snowball-y it is, I think is maybe the best way to say it. But all of your cards are better, like, the less disrupted you are, and all of your cards get sort of exponentially worse the more you're facing disruption.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, and I was mentioning this to you earlier, but it looked a little bit like Venerated Loxodon was mostly Windmore every time I saw it cast. Like, if you're actually casting it for Convoke 5, you're usually already doing okay, and it doesn't really add as much to the equation as you'd hope.
Yeah, I have that thought with a lot of the cards in this deck, to be totally honest. I think that it's definitely powerful, but I worry that this deck is too linear to be successful as the format adapts.
Right.
Like, it's... all the cards are good, right? You're not really playing any stinkers outside of maybe Sapperling Migration, but you're kind of a one-trick pony, right? Like, we're trying to cast, like, March of the Multitudes into second gigantic March of the Multitudes. That's basically the game plan.
Right.
And that's really powerful, but if your opponent is able to knock you off of the first one, like, say I play a Goblin Chain Whirler, the turn you're setting up for a march, and it's going to kill, like, two or three creatures. So, you know, maybe that's more than it will usually get, but let's just say that's what it is. You can't march in response, right, because the creatures will die, but if you can only march for two or three after, it really weakens your board position substantially. So, and let alone if your opponent is playing, you know, Ritual of Soot or Deafening Clarions. Like, there are just a lot of ways that you can get your board swept up and it not only take things off that board, but because we're playing so many things with Convoke and so many things that benefit from having additional bodies, like the backside of Flower to Flourish, Legion's Landing, etc. Like, every sweeper doesn't only take away from your board right now, but it takes away from your ability to produce a relevant board in the turns following the sweeper.
Right. Yeah, that all makes a lot of sense to me. The last thing that I didn't really care for about this deck is just that you would think that a token strategy would be pretty great against some, like, spot removal, especially premium removal, like something like Assassin's Trophy, where there's like an actual drawback to it.
Right.
But this deck doesn't strike me that way. Like, you have things that are so important, like Shalai, and you know, like Tristani can be a big one if it gets Assassin's Trophy in combat, or like, and you're playing 12 enchantments. Like, it's just, it strikes me as odd that you would play a go wide strategy that also just gets hit by the removal spell that it's trying to dodge.
I agree. My inclination is that Venerated Loxodon is a very good defensive card, but not as good an aggressive card as you'd like it to be. And I have some ideas for how you might try to make this deck more resilient to just removal spells and sweepers in general going forward. I think if you were interested, you could try to build something that would be more functional with, say, like Militia Bugler. I think Militia Bugler getting Tristani specifically is an incredibly cool interaction.
And yeah, that sounds kind of cool. Yeah. I think, honestly, in the past, most of the best tokens decks that we've ever seen have had, like, a pretty reasonable mid-range game instead of being, you know, all in on the tokens theme.
Yeah, I just think building the deck in such a snowball-y way is kind of exploitable. That being said, obviously, first and second is pretty incredible, so congrats to Eric Schumann and Todd Stevens. But this is a deck that, admittedly, I don't love these token strategies, but I would be a little bit wary of this the next week or two.
Right.
So following green-white tokens, we have Boros Angels, which did reasonably well at the PTQ, had one top eight in the open, and then won the Classic, I believe. So it had a pretty good weekend, all in all, a pretty balanced weekend. And this is a weird one. This is one that, to me, on paper, kind of looks like nonsense.
Yeah, this deck looks like complete garbage on paper. But that being said, this was actually the deck that I was the most impressed with this weekend. Like, this deck just actually looked great when it was actually being played. Which is, I mean, even still, as I look at the deck list now, it's kind of mind-blowing to me. And this is actually a more tempered version than some of the other ones that we've seen. Like, I saw a version playing Rekindling Phoenixes in addition to all these angels. I'm not sure whose list this is I'm looking at. It looks like the first place list from the Classic.
Yeah, there were some interesting ones from the PTQ that got swept up under this, but the one from the Classic, or the I'm just going to look at the fifth place one from the Open, which looks... it's basically all white cards, then Lightning Strikes, Aurelias, and Deafening Clarions. But I think looking at this deck, one of the things that really strikes me is that it probably does a really good job of transitioning roles. Like, you have a lot of cards that can play defensively against red decks, or relatively aggressively against control decks.
Yeah.
And one of the things we were talking about earlier is the power of Deafening Clarion in a shell like this. First of all, you do play a surprising number of creatures that survive the sweeper side. So if you have like Aurelia and Shalai or Aurelia and Lyra or something like that, you can actually cast it for both sides and wipe your opponent's board while keeping your board. But unlike most sweepers, you can also play Deafening Clarion while you're just ahead on board just to give lifelink, you know, and make an attack in the air, gain 15 life, and just put the game away.
Yeah, just definitely press your advantage in that way. So yeah, that's a really cool effect for this deck. The other thing that I thought was pretty interesting, and this isn't come up in the list from the Classic as much, but one of the lists that was on coverage was playing Rekindling Phoenix in the main, and then he had some Cleansing Novas in the sideboard. And that was kind of cool, too. Like, he was able to kind of press an advantage with Rekindling Phoenixes, and then eventually he had to cast Cleansing Nova because he was falling behind on the board. But it definitely didn't hurt him as badly as it would have if he was playing, you know, any other 4-drop.
Sure. And Clarion can do some of those same things with something like a Rekindling Phoenix, right? Like,
definitely, yeah.
It can just sort of swing the game in a multitude of ways at the same time. I think one of the big advantages of this deck is that against red, you just have so much incidental life gain in addition to, you know, History Benali might not attack red that well these days, but I think it's going to be played defense against red pretty well. Mm-hmm. And when you look at a deck with three Shalais and Resplendent Angels and Lyras, you just have a lot of ways to get out of, like, I don't anticipate this deck losing to top deck risk factors very often.
Right, definitely. I mean, he's even watching a game, he wasn't even playing against Mono Red, he was playing against Green-White Tokens, and he had a Lyra and a Shalai in play, and that interaction is very powerful. I know it's not, like, new or anything, but just the Shalai having lifelink was very important.
Sure, all of a sudden you realize that even if you're being blocked, you're gaining 10 life a turn or whatever.
Right.
You can just sort of ignore March of the Multitudes and keep attacking.
Yeah, it's an effective Lyra Dawnbringer that it used to not come up very often, but if this deck is real, I expect more people to realize that, you know,
yeah,
it actually does pump your other angels.
Well, and Aurelia Lyra is pretty gross as well, right? Because you can give your Lyra Vigilance as well as pumping it.
Yeah, definitely.
And Lyra Resplendent Angel is pretty sweet. So I think just, like, without Glorybringer and without Chandra to really make Shalai look embarrassing, I think this deck is pretty real going forward.
Yeah, Shalai was very impressive in, you know, what I saw a lot of the day. It looked like a lot of people, not so much out of the control decks, but out of the more mid-rangey and aggressive white decks, they were playing Settle the Wreckages as their sideboard plan, and, you know, Shalai just makes that look silly.
Yeah, that's. I think this deck is kind of weak to actual Wrath of God, but it's very powerful against Settle the Wreckage specifically, and if you happen to be some combination of Settle the Wreckage and Invalidating Cast Down is pretty powerful as well, because
right.
I do think that's one of the better removal spells in this format right now, and one that we'll continue to see some play going forward. So I think this deck just, like, incidentally has a fairly good mid-range matchup at times, but where you're really going to see this deck be punishing is this is not the deck you want across from the table from you if you're playing mono red.
Yeah, I mean, this deck mostly invalidates Cast Down just by playing mono legendary creatures, right? It's four creatures that have hexproof from black, four creatures that you can pay life to make indestructible, and then 12 legends, or, you know,
Resplendent Angel's not
legends.
Legendary, so you have exactly one good target.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's kind of unbelievable how bad Cast Down is against this deck.
Right, which is interesting because I do think Cast Down was a totally reasonable choice going into this weekend, and now it's something I might shy away from pretty hard.
Yeah, definitely.
So I think this deck is really, really in a good spot moving forward. It looks like these lists were mostly playing Settle the Wreckages in the sideboard, and I'm not sure how good that will be as your deck becomes more and more known. But one of the things I do like about a deck like this is that I think you're often going to be able to get far enough ahead on board that your opponent's only outs are going to be attacking into you.
Yeah, I mean, I can definitely imagine scenarios where they just can't realistically attack with, you know, two creatures or whatever because...
Just the volume of lifelink, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, and just having a creature that can just, you know, if they're making one chump attack, they kind of have to make a pretty large commitment to make it make sense.
Yeah, I like Settle a little more out of this deck, but I still think that in general, Settle gets a lot worse as the deck lists are known.
Yeah.
So that might be something you can look at going forward if you're looking for things to change. That being said, I do like this deck. Deafening Clarion is kind of a cool innovation compared to a lot of the stuff we've seen. And I think this is, you know, you're playing a lot of just powerful magic cards.
Yeah, it's really interesting, actually. Like, it feels like it's mostly a deck designed to be the best Deafening Clarion shell more than anything else, right? Just because it's exactly what you would want to design for that card.
Yes, both halves make sense. And I think that card happens to be pretty good in the meta.
Yeah, and also just again. Like it's something that buys you enough time to be able to cast all these, you know, 4 and 5 drops.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. It's a really nice bridge. It's sort of playing like Goblin. It's sort of playing like this deck's Goblin Chain Whirler.
Right.
And having your Odonto Vanguards be able to live through it when, like, basically for free, right? Because if you just give them life
link, it's interesting. The synergy that it has with that card.
It's very cool. So coming in second, it looks like we have Black Green Mid, also with 24 points. This deck did better in the PTQ than it did in anything else. MTG Goldfish is being a little bit weird about how it's actually labeling these. But the PTQ had a bunch of Black Green Mid decks that did reasonably well. It was also won by a Black Green Mid deck. So there are a whole bunch of shells sort of in this same ballpark, not just the winning list, but there are like a bunch of sort of Abzan style decks that look similar. But the basic formula seems to be like a bunch of Explore guys, some Planeswalkers, a bunch of Assassin's Trophies, Golgari Find Broker, and some Eldest Reborns.
So I want to talk a little bit about Golgari Find Broker. Have you had much experience with that card?
I've played with it a little bit, but I did not like these decks that much for the week one metagame. Shows what I know, clearly. but I could not come to a list that I loved, so I have not played with that card specifically.
Sure. The Find Broker just doesn't seem very powerful to me. I mean, maybe I'm underestimating how good the 3/4 body is, but I mean, 4 mana for a card it's fine, but it's not. It's just interesting to me how popular the card is. Like, it's usually a 3 or 4 of in most lists.
So most of the PTQ lists actually only had one. It's a 3 of. I think it gets better the more Eldest Reborns you play. I think specifically that interaction is fairly strong if you're playing a grindy game. It's right. Very hard to answer Golgari Find Broker, rebuying Eldest Reborn, rebuying Golgari Find Broker over and over again.
Right. Yeah. That's certainly an interaction that I was planning to cover. I think that is specifically kind of powerful. I mean, and maybe there's some things going on with Vraska as well. But
yeah, I think if you want to play a high density of Vraskas, I think if you're just rebuying creatures, it's relatively weak. One of the cool interactions that it has is with Deadweight. Being able to rebuy a cheap removal spell is kind of a neat one as well.
Yeah, that's kind of cute.
Yeah, I think against the red decks, that's potentially pretty powerful. But I think these black-green decks in general, the shell is really loose, I would say, compared to a lot of these other shells. There's like a lot more room for innovation and sort of putting your own stamp on things. So the decks really broke down into a number of categories. The one that won the PTQ was playing, I believe, six Vraskas, 3 of each, and another Planeswalker as well, maybe a Karn.
It was playing a Vivian Reed.
Okay, a Vivian Reed in the main deck. But there were other ones playing, like, no Assassin's Trophies, a bunch of Find Finalities, and some Gruesome Menageries, which is also kind of an interesting direction that things could go. Some playing Wild Growth Walker, some not. Like, there are a whole bunch of kind of different directions this deck could go, depending on, you know, what card or combination of cards you were finding appealing.
Yeah, it's interesting to see how much, even breaking down the entire strategy, it's interesting to see how much diversity there is. Like, I wouldn't consider the Wild Growth Walker decks and this even trying to win through the same access, right? Like, they are both mid-range decks technically, but it's they function very differently.
I agree. I mostly just want to kind of highlight both of them just to show the depth that it looks like is there in this archetype.
Right.
My biggest divide would probably come down to whether or not you feel like you're a Stitcher supplier deck. I think that decks playing Stitcher supplier are just like pretty fundamentally moving away from like a true mid-range strategy.
Right.
But
more of an engine deck at that point.
Yes, but the Stitcher supplier, Fine Finality, Gruesome Menagerie kind of engine is definitely powerful. It's kind of in the sense that the PTQ winning deck is going over the top of opponents with like looping Fine Brokers. This deck is sort of the other variants are sort of going over the top of opponents by just like playing a whole bunch of 2-for-1s.
Right. Yeah, I would. I mean, the overarching theme though is playing a bunch of 2-for-1s, whether they're, you know, Golgari Fine Brokers or Vraskas or Gruesome Menageries or whatever, and premium removal spells is going to be a recipe for a pretty decent deck.
I agree. I also think that, like, my impression has been that the mana in this format is surprisingly underwhelming in a lot of these decks, and that one thing the black-green deck actually gets just, like, an advantage over the other decks on is mana, and that's because of your high number of explore creatures.
Right.
I think this deck is just good. It's good at hitting land drops. It's good at staying relatively balanced. It doesn't have to play anything besides Fine Broker with a very difficult mana cost. And realistically, Fine Broker like gets better as the game goes on anyways. It's not really a turn 4 play most of the time. So
yeah,
I think
certainly
this,
often.
I think this deck just like naturally has pretty good mana. And I think that is like without having to exclude cards you would like to play. And I think that's a pretty big advantage, like when we're looking at sort of Esper having somewhat sketchy mana and even the Boros Angels deck being a little bit suspect at times.
Right. And I know we had this conversation a little bit before this weekend, and I was talking about how it seems like the 2-drop slot is where most decks are hurting right now. Like, it's really hard to find multiple playable 2-drops in your colors.
Mm-hmm.
And that really makes me want to play Llanowar Elves, so I can kind of gloss over the 2-drops slot.
I think,
and that looks like what the PTQ winning deck kind of also went down that road.
Yeah, I think that's one option. The other option that some people have gone down is playing the Seeker Squires in addition to the Branchwalkers. And I think that's defensible as well. I don't think that card is incredibly powerful, but I do think that just like having a bunch of explore cards, especially in combination with Wild Growth Walker, gives you you are going to help fix your draw step.
Yeah, it is true to some extent, but that's kind of the opposite direction that I'm talking about though, right? Like, I'm saying I don't want to have to play cards like Seeker Squire, so I'd much rather just play a way to kind of get around that.
Right, and
To be fair, I don't think that Merfolk Branchwalker is a great card either, but...
Sure, but it's a little bit more of a body on offense.
Right.
Yeah, I think that that's a totally valid way to look at it as well, and I think a lot of it depends on sort of how you envision your... what you envision your role to be in some of these games. Like, if you look at the PTQ winning deck list by Yamakiller, I think it's clear that he's a little more reliant on 1-for-1 removal and really grinding out 2-for-1s with Fine Broker and Aldisterborn, where a lot of these other decks are playing a bunch of Finalities main deck. So if you're looking at generating advantage in kind of different ways, when we're playing more of a kind of a big mid-range deck or almost control deck in some of these matchups, it makes sense to me that, like, given Assassin's Trophy, cast down, stuff like that, I'm more comfortable just passing with mana open on turn 2 and trying to react to my opponent's play sometimes, when I'm playing a more proactive strategy where my goal is really to force my opponent to maybe overcommit to the board and then blow them out with a Fine Finality into a Gruesome Menagerie, something along those lines, my inclination is to play 2-drops even if they're not the most intrinsically powerful.
Sure, yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
It just sort of depends on what my overarching game plan is. And I think that the list that won the PTQ is a little more of a traditional mid-range deck. So that deck had a pretty good weekend, although it did not have a lot of success at the Star City event. So I'm curious to see where that moves going forward. But I get the inclination that there are sort of multiple decks under one heading that just happen to be black-green, and that really trying to call those two decks the same thing is just somewhat misleading.
Yeah, I agree with that completely.
So I think that they're both like reasonable options and worth exploring. It just kind of depends on, you know, what exactly you're looking for. Whether you're looking to play something with a little more of an engine, or whether you're looking for a deck with just a lot of 2-for-1s and kind of some incidental card advantage. Moving past black-green, though, that brings us to mono-red, which finished with 31 points, put up a bunch of good finishes in the various Star City events, but did not do very well in the online PTQ.
Yeah, I would say that saying that it didn't do well in the online PTQ would be the understatement of the century.
Sure, mostly just didn't show up.
It just actually, yeah, just nobody that played it finished in like the top 32 or whatever. Like,
I think there was exactly one.
Yeah, it was kind of unreal for a deck that looks like it's probably the best deck after week one. That's very surprising to me. What do you make of that data?
It's hard to say. So this is what I played at the SCG this weekend, and it felt pretty reasonable to me. I'm not sure the exact best way to build it, anything like that, but my inclination is that your just straight aggressive beatdown plan is worse than it has ever been.
That's probably a side effect of your 2-drops being pretty bad, and like your 1-drops are even worse than that.
Yeah. The 1 and 2-drops are completely abysmal. Runaway Steamkin is fantastic. Goblin Chain Whirler is still a good Magic card. I don't know that it's particularly insane in this metagame or anything, but it's a good card. But just, you know, card quality wise, you're never sad about casting a Goblin Chain Whirler. But these decks really have sort of moved towards Risk Factor and Experimental Frenzy, along with Runaway Steamkin, as kind of the, like, if I'm playing this deck, those are the reasons that I'm doing so.
Right. It's interesting to me, too. So I have here pulled up the third place list from the Team Open. And he's only playing 2 Risk Factors.
Yeah, so specifically, I think Max McVitie identified that Risk Factor is not particularly good with Experimental Frenzy, and it's not particularly good in multiples. Drawing 1 is really great, but drawing too many... I think he's trying to bump down the number of 3-drops ever so slightly when he's increased... Like, he's playing at least one more 4 than any other list.
Sure, and it makes sense. I mean, with Experimental Frenzy, not only is Risk Factor bad because they can just let you draw the cards and then you have to like pop off your Frenzy to actually get them, but it's also bad because it's another, you know, high CMC that makes it harder to just churn through the top of your deck.
Yeah, it kind of goes both ways. The flip side is that your opponents will also always give you cards when you have Experimental Frenzy in play, which sounds like a good idea until it's not.
Right, yeah. I mean, obviously, eventually, you know, they are on layaway. You can eventually get those cards back.
I definitely had one or two opponents, like, let me draw 6 and then, you know, die on their next turn when I just popped Experimental Frenzy and went, like, burn spell.
Right, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that seems like probably a mistake on your opponent's part, but...
Yes, it definitely... They're only tucked away. They're... They're gone but not forgotten.
Right.
So, there's some interesting tension there, and you don't want to have a lot of them going at the same time. Certainly, if I were to play another event tomorrow, I think I might lean towards something more like what Max McVitie played compared to the list that I ended up on. But,
another really interesting part of his
list.
There's
awkward tension. There's awkward tension no matter how you build it, for sure.
Right. So another really interesting thing about his list in particular is that he's playing 2 Experimental Frenzies and 2 Rekindling Phoenixes. This is a really hard one for me to understand personally, because generally speaking, when you do a split like this kind of split, it's because they both function somewhat similarly but have different applications in different scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I do expect that you would rather have one of each than two experimental frenzies at least. But that just strikes me as a man that doesn't really know what he wants to do, you know.
I sort of agree. It's a little bit tricky. I think of these. I had this experience in testing for this event as well that like I could never quite figure out what the correct way to have this built was. Just in the sense that like there you have a lot of really powerful cards, but a lot of them don't really play that well together. And then you're sort of trying to make up for the very weak power level of your like one drops and your two drops outside of Runaway Steamkin by trying to just include more powerful cards in your deck. And Rekindling Phoenix and Experimental Frenzy, while extremely different and not really going that well together, they are both extremely powerful in one way or another. So when I look at what Max McVitie did, I think that ultimately he probably decided that although they were sort of awkward together and weren't really good in the same spots, he just needed to be able to play the most powerful deck both pre and post board that he's able to, and I think that his list does a reasonable job of doing that.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, I can believe that. It's just interesting, right? Because he could have easily gone with like four Rekindling Phoenixes main, or and like, you know, three frenzies in the board. Because you can see that he has a split up both in the board as well.
Right. I mean,
he clearly likes to go up or down in some matchups. But right. Is this just like, you know, trying to be on the run good lifestyle and just draw the right ones in the right spots, or does it have something to do with not wanting to draw multiple experimental frenzies?
Well, double experimental frenzy is always bad. But I think it does have something to do with the fact that I think his list is actually set up really well for the red mirror in game one. I think Phoenix gets a lot weaker in the post-board games, but is quite good in game one. And Risk Factor is likely your weakest card. I think both Frenzy and Phoenix are phenomenal in that matchup. Okay. Where Risk Factor is a little bit linear and very unlikely to do anything other than... If you're not winning already, it's not going to do anything.
Okay. And then you think that just the presence of Lava Coil makes Rekindling Phoenix more of a liability in the post-board games?
I think it's still good. I think it's just less good.
Right.
My favorite list is actually the list in 24th place by Patrick McGregor. And his list is only playing 18 creatures, so his second one-drop of choice outside of Gitu Lava Runner is Goblin Banneret, and he's only playing two. And then he's playing a main deck Lava Coil, Shivan Fire, and Treasure Map, along with only two Risk Factors and three Experimental Frenzies. I'm not a huge fan of his sideboard, but I do like his main deck. A lot of the things I was trying to do in the mirror, it looks like he's sort of leaning towards in the main. And I think assuming that this would be the most popular matchup in the Week 1 metagame makes some sense.
Yeah, the Goblin Bannerets specifically are very interesting to me.
Yeah, a few people played them.
It's really interesting. I mean, he's not playing any Fanatical Firebrands.
I think that's a good choice. That card,
yeah,
although it's good at
reasonable.
Killing Llanowar Elves, is pretty abysmal, basically, all the rest of the time.
Yeah, I can definitely agree with not wanting to play it. I don't think that it's a... it's basically never been a good card outside of... you know, Gate to the Afterlife shenanigans.
Right.
But Goblin Banneret just seems possibly even worse than that. Like, it's interesting. It kind of reads like Satyr Fire Dancer, or what was that called? Satyr Fire Drinker, maybe?
Yeah. But it pumps two for two mana rather than one for two mana.
Right, but that was also like a 2/1 for one on its face.
Right, but then the flip side is that he added two more removal spells to the main deck.
Mm-hmm.
So I think in terms of being able to clear the way or trade Banneret for bigger creatures and use it as an extra removal spell by threatening to pump it, I think he may have found a better like, I would imagine his list is better in the red mirror.
Interesting.
I also sideboarded Treasure Maps and they were phenomenal in the red mirrors.
Yeah, I mean, that makes a lot of sense. You know, it was always pretty good at generating card advantage, but the problem was that there were just too many breeds, and you would just get kind of blown out by it.
Right, and now there's none of that, so they're never dying. They make your frenzies better. They eventually will generate you a bunch of cards, and it's very hard to just snowball the red matchups away right now because all the creatures are so bad.
Right.
Like, you have to cut most, if not all, of the X ones to avoid getting Chain Whirlered out of the game. Because that's kind of the only way you can really lose to a single creature, is if you're getting 2 or 3 for 1 by a Goblin Chain Whirler. So...
Yeah, like, Chain Whirler is the only way that your opponent can really mount up an advantage, so, like, letting them just have free creatures off of it is kind of a disaster.
Right. So my sideboard plan in the mirror involved cutting all the risk factors, all of the Viashino Pyromancers, and all of the Fanatical Firebrands.
Right. And I assume that Risk Factor got the axe because it's just a little bit slow if they're giving you the cards and, like, it doesn't really impact the board.
My experience was that you were never getting the cards.
Yeah, I would assume that it's pretty rare.
You were only getting the cards when you'd already won the game, and any spell would have done it.
Right.
And other than that, it was too inflexible. Just, if you're behind 8 to the face out of one card, while it sounds fine, just doesn't actually do anything. And if you're ahead, I just want a card that, like, can kill a Rekindling Phoenix or has more text. So my innovation in the mirror was to sideboard treasure maps as well as dismissive pyromancers to be able to keep the Wizard's Lightning Wizard count slightly higher, filter through the deck, and the goal was to make the deck as good an experimental frenzy deck as possible, because that's probably the number one advantage you can leverage in the mirror.
Okay.
I don't think the Diamond Mares are very good. I tried those a little bit, and they were pretty poor. But I think there's a lot of room to innovate in the mirror, if that's something that interests you.
Yeah, definitely. It certainly looks like there is some flexibility in the lists, which is kind of surprising for a mono-red deck this, you know, at this point in the format.
I would say that this mono-red deck is a little bit different than most, in that it's not really a volume deck. It's actually somehow kind of a haymaker deck. Basically, Runaway Steamkin is absurd. Goblin Chain Whirler is still very good, especially on the play. And Experimental Frenzy is maybe a little bit uneven, but at its best is crazy.
Yeah, it's interesting that you say that, because Experimental Frenzy does strike me as a card that, you know, kind of belongs in a volume deck, but I guess itself is a haymaker, right? Like,
yeah,
it really rewards you a lot for having very low mana costs.
What it really rewards you for is playing a lot of burn spells.
And low land counts, too, right? Like, it rewards you for both of those things.
Lower land counts, yes, but just hitting every land drop for the rest of the game is pretty powerful. It's really good with a high instant count, especially instants that are unconditional, so like Shock and Lightning Strike are pretty outstanding, because you can... one of the things you can do with those cards is, like, on your opponent's end step or in your own upkeep or whenever makes sense mana-wise, you can start just casting those in rapid succession until you hit a land, draw the land for turn, and then continue to play. So if your opponent can't get Experimental Frenzy out of play, it's very, very challenging.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense to me.
So just playing a lot of spells, really. Things that are non-creatures, and it's obviously, for those of you who haven't seen this interaction in play yet, the Runaway Steamkin Experimental Frenzy interaction is completely absurd. If you're
actually, it's kind of just like something that, you know, you're generating theoretically infinite cards, and some amount of mana every time, like the third spell every turn just like gives you a free Desperate Ritual.
Well, one of the lists I tested for this event was an actual combo deck by Sam Black, where you used Runaway Steamkin and Skurk Prospector in combination with Dark Dweller Oracle to cast your whole deck.
Okay. How do you get the lands out of there?
You use Dark Dweller Oracle to exile the top card of your library.
Oh, okay. That's the 2-drop that you can pay 1 to exile the top card?
1 and sacrifice a creature, but yes.
Right, yeah, okay.
So it was like that, and a bunch of Steamkins and Siege Gang Commanders and Prospectors and Goblin War Chiefs.
Right,
and
when you started going,
you could actually just, like, play your entire deck.
Yeah, that's kind of some cool design space.
Yeah, there are actually some infinite combos with a Squeezy Immortal if you can get enough Steamkins going.
Okay, sure. Yeah, why not?
So the deck ultimately was probably a little too weak to sweepers, but there are some really wild things you can do, and ultimately, you know, you might not go infinite, but it kind of feels like it when you go, you know, main phase, shock you, cast a Chain Whirler, make 3 mana with my Runaway Steamkin, Lightning Strike you, Wizards Lightning you. Your opponent's like, okay, take 12, that seems bad. You know, and while that sounds like Magical Christmas Land, I can tell you that I saw a lot of games end, you know, over... If your opponent can't kill you in the next turn or two, it doesn't matter if you draw lands.
Sure.
Right, if they can't put pressure on you to end the game, you will just get deep in your deck quickly and find more spells.
Yep, this makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, so it's powerful. It's like somewhere between Outpost Siege and like Future Sight, which is, you know, that sounds like a card I'm interested in playing.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. I mean, Future Sight was pretty broken, so
it has a little bit of that going on. Obviously, it's not quite that good, but it also only costs 3 and a red rather than, you know, 2 triple blues.
Yeah, its mana cost is much easier, and also, you know, it costs 1 less mana. And I think they've learned some lessons, you know, in the years of printing Magic cards or whatever, but obviously it has some drawbacks, right? Like not being able to play cards from your hand is the biggest and most obvious difference, but
definitely. What I would say the big thing is, though, is that if it stays in play and you're not dead, you will hit a land drop basically every turn, almost no matter what. So what ends up happening is anything that accumulates in your hand, you can usually at some point, you know, pop Experimental Frenzy, then untap and play every card in your hand.
Right.
So yeah. It sets up these, like, explosive turns, followed by eventually bricking into lands, followed by get rid of Experimental Frenzy and play everything I drew.
Yeah.
So
it's interesting. I mean, the play pattern you describe just kind of leads you down a road of not really playing an aggro deck, right? Like,
well, that's kind of what I'm saying. These aren't aggro decks. These are burn decks.
Right. And they're more like combo-y burn decks than traditional burn decks. Like even cards like Risk Factor, right? Like you're never expecting that to deal the last 4 points of damage because that would be weird.
Right. So there's maybe some question as to whether or not we should be playing Flame of Kells instead. But
instead of Risk Factors or instead of Frenzies?
Well, instead of Frenzies, if we should lean more on a traditional burn deck. But what I will say is that the reason to play this deck at a fundamental level is Runaway Steamkin. Runaway Steamkin is incredibly powerful.
Okay.
Everything else is sort of secondary and probably down to preference to some extent, but Runaway Steamkin is incredible.
Yeah, that's interesting.
It attacks.
Yeah, I look forward to, you know, seeing what kind of things we have coming from mono red going forward.
Yeah, I think there's a
surprising
amount of
space. And all these decks, really, there's just a lot of.
In all of them, right? I mean, we were looking at the Golgari deck, and there's all these deck building choices. We're looking at that in mono red. We're looking at that in really everything, and we didn't even get to some of the stranger control decks like the Teferi Azor's Gateway deck from the PTQ. There are some really wild ones out there.
Yeah, I agree. There's almost no consensus on, you know, any of the list right now, and it's going to be really interesting to see what happens going forward.
That's kind of fun. I think there were 51 decks in this last standard deck dump.
Wow.
Which is kind of incredible. I mean, 51 is like, that's a lot. So I've enjoyed this set so far. It looks to me like they've done a pretty good job giving us a bunch of options. And I'm sure things will narrow down a fair bit, as they always do. But, you know, it's not often you get a standard deck dump with 51 decks, so and enjoy it. Yeah, I was kind of shocked by that. I saw that in a, I think an Aaron Forsyth tweet and wondered if he'd made a typo.
Like 51, it can't really be 51, right?
Yeah, and then you start looking through it and you're like, oh man. Yeah, it's just actually like anything you can think of someone managed to 5-0 with.
Right.
It's so kind of cool. Yeah, I mean that about covers it for this week. I think that this standard format is shaping up to be pretty interesting. We saw some really divergent results. It's interesting to see a deck kind of dominate an open and then be notably absent from an online PTQ.
Yeah, and vice versa. It's very interesting to see the way that the metagames broke down this week. It was almost like there were like three different standard formats. Or at least, right. You know, at least two, the SCG and the online PTQ.
Yeah, so there's some really interesting stuff going on in standard. Seems to me like a good chance at being a good format. There are a lot of these 5-0 decks that look interesting to me. I've tried some really weird stuff. I'll try at some point this week to make a deck dump of my own in the critics group, but there's lots of cards I'm interested in trying. Really interested in some of these Golgari decks. Really interested in various Niv-Mizzet decks.
Yeah, Niv-Mizzet notably absent from our top five decks, but the card seems powerful.
It was the 10th most played card in this deck dump, or the 10th most played creature in the deck dump. So,
how about that?
Yeah, you know, there's some stuff just under the surface, kind of simmering away there for sure. There are some wild ones, and I think that we might see some really cool decks. I have certainly found that playing with a lot of these cards, I've been really impressed with them from a design standpoint.
Right.
But that about does it for this week. You can find me on Facebook. My name is Michael Hinderocker. You can find Matt on Facebook at Matthew Kling. You can find me on Twitter at MagicMikeMTG. You can find Matt on Twitter at TheWitchKling. You can talk to us all, Spencer included, in our Facebook group. That's the Constructed Criticism family on Facebook. You can find the Constructed Critics group on Facebook as well for patrons of $5 or more. We look forward to continuing to sort of digest this standard format with you guys, and hope that we all learn something from this. You can also check out the Discord, which I believe is under Heezy Gaming Media. So it's not solely Magic focused, but there's a lot of Magic talk in there. I think there's a link to that in the Facebook group, so go ahead and join that group. You know, you're trying to do basically anything but sell us spray bands, and we're into it.
I'm the only one that's tried to do that so far, so, you know.
Fair enough. Well, Matt, as an administrator, can do what he wants. That's the stuff you got to put up with. That's the kind of abuse of power that runs rampant. So, what did you have any kind of just broader takeaways from this week, standard, or just the set, limited, anything?
Yeah, I've just been really enjoying things so far. I got a chance to play some limited this week, and that's been a pretty good time. It's impressive how different these archetypes are in addition to everything else, and I think I really learned a lot about the dynamics of the mono red deck from, you know, just talking to you just now. And also I learned that, you know, Boros Angels should be, you know, better be classified as Deafening Clarion dot deck. So
yeah, it's kind of wild. There's some cool stuff going on in this format. And I've mostly enjoyed the limited games that I've gotten to play as well. So
yeah,
kind of excited going forward. I think that now the two big sets that we've had, I thought Dominaria was quite a good set, and I think this one is as well. So it's hard to ask for much more than that.
Yeah, I agree.
That's what we're hoping for. So I think that about does it for this week. We will see you next week with maybe some musings about Ravnica Team Sealed, and, you know, maybe the only musing will be, I wish we were better at it.
Yep, that's as it often is after, you know, a GP. Wish I was a little bit better at this.
Oh, I have that thought all the time. It just does. It's not as helpful as I wish it was. Anyways, thanks for joining us. Hope you enjoyed, and we will see you next week.
See ya. We'll be right back.
Magic, magic, magic.